Once more into the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach on this Saturday, March 12th, 2016, where you were here, Jake, say... Oh, okay. That well, I guess you heard him say it. That was it.
My yeah, throat. Okay. Well, that's all I was saying.
That's all I'm saying. Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. See, we can do that. Yeah.
I always feel a little bit like the Three Amigos movie. When
hey, we could do worse. I like those three.
Two
amigos.
Of us. Yeah.
Yeah.
Only kill one of them.
Well, I like these guys. Only kill one of them.
Dos amigos. Okay. Anyway, the market, as we said, is up from where it was down, and that's a good thing. It is down from the highest it's ever been. As a matter of fact, if you want the really gory details, the low in this particular set of lows, which include beginning in September, coming back up, and then going back down and hitting a bottom on the last day of February. I know, I guess it was February 11th that hit bottom. On February 11th, it hit bottom. And its low was, the S&P 500 low was 1,810. And it's currently at 2011, which means it's up 11% from where it was about a month ago, which is good. And if it would just keep doing that for the rest of the year, we'd be really, really happy. Of course, then we would have a bubble. But last year in May, it was at 2135. So can it get to 2135 again by this May? Yes, it can. And one of the reasons I think that is conceivable is because nobody expects it to. And there seems to be a consensus that the market is not likely to go up any further. Of course, there's been that consensus since February 11th when it hit bottom, which as long as that consensus is there, that the market really can't go up any further, we probably see rises in the market.
Right. There was a story that came out this week as well about housing and recovery. The net worth of Americans, U.S. citizens, has recovered since the collapse. It is back. Now we're breaking into new territory for net worth. That's happened for several months. The worth of real estate in the net worth of Americans has now recovered to the point it was in 2007 when breaking new records.
So is that in Fort Worth?
No, not Fort Worth. Allworth.
Allworth.
Worth.
Allworth,
yes.
Yes.
Woolworth.
Well,
no,
yeah.
Not.
Woolworth is bankrupt.
So that concept is really fascinating. We are now considered to be in expansion in all parts of our economy. Mm-hmm. We've now finished the recovery. Now, since then, other people have not been buying houses. So as you look at the younger generation, they're saving up to buy houses. And that's going to cause the price of houses to probably mm-hmm. come up and probably come up a bit to get kind of in trend with the long-term average, which is you generally get back what you put into a house with inflation and taxes. And that's the long-term truth.
There's In looking at the numbers in the stock market, I came across something this morning. This is Jeff. I came across something this morning as I was doing my numerical calculations that I thought was pretty fascinating. And I probably was lurking around in the back of my head, but I really wasn't aware of it until now. And that is, if we go back to 1994, and the reason I'm using 1994 is that was the beginning of the bull run that led up to 2000. There was a minor, almost recession in 1994. Didn't quite make it into recession, and we had a minor correction in 2000 in 1994. From there, the stock market roared up into 2000, and then down to 2002, and then back up in 2007, and then back down, and now back up again. And of course, importantly, the market is higher today. It was around 1,500, the S&P 500, at the peak in 2000. And today it is a lot higher. It's 2022. Now, the average, if we take out inflation, and we include the dividends of the S&P 500. In other words, in a real sense, the dividends offset inflation almost perfectly. So what we get is an average annual rate of return from the beginning of the bull market that led into the 90s to the present of 5.68% a year. Let me say that again. If we take out inflation, we have the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index giving us a return of 5.68% a year. Did we get a higher return than that? Yeah, the CPI rate during that period was about 2.2%. So what we wound up with is a stock market that, if you actually went and looked at it, returned about 8% a year during that period. But if you had to pull out inflation. And the concept of the United States stock market returning between 5 and 6% a year for 20 years is, to the people in my generation at least, pretty alien, particularly when we throw in the fact that the first 6 years of that, we had double-digit returns in the market, and we got used to double-digit returns in the market. We thought that was kind of our constitutional right to have double-digit returns in the market, and we wanted much higher numbers, and we wanted much higher returns. The fact is that that return of about 6%, a little less than 6%, after we adjust for inflation, is pretty close to what we've actually seen in corporate profitability during the period. In other words, the market has been cruising along at the profit ratio of its underlying components during that period. Now, it got out of control, and then it went to the other side, and it got out of control and went to the other side. So what that means going forward, if you are thinking about returns, long-term returns in the stock market, if you were to invest in a S&P 500 index fund, thinking that's the place to go, which, by the way, seems to be a massive move of money, just like it was in the late 1990s, there's this massive move of money going on into index funds, and specifically the S&P 500 index funds, thinking you're going to get a much higher long-term return. In reality, what history is telling us right now, what recent history is telling us right now, is that you will get maybe a 5 to 6% return. And this is based on history. The future is always uncertain. But between a 5 and 6% return with a higher variance, a higher volatility than you probably would get in some place where somebody was holding some cash or some bonds or something else in your investment. That's one of those realities that's really hard to get our minds around. It's a reality I have a lot of trouble accepting because, among other things, the first person I actually heard or read making this comment was Bill Gross, who I don't like. But he's the one that said there's a new normal where this kind of return in the market going forward will be the norm for some time. Now, is that going to go on forever? No, I don't think so. I think once we get past the negativity, we're going to see an expansion in the price-earnings ratio. There's only a very few elements in the stock market, and the expansion or contraction of the price-earnings ratio is one of them. One of them is inflation, and one of them is earnings.
A price-to-earnings ratio, for those of you who didn't study economics or look into the market, it's a ratio of earnings to price. So a really simple way of looking at that is, if you've got a piece of rental property, if it's paying you enough rent that you would get your initial investment back in 5 years, then you've got a price to earnings ratio of 5. So the income into the price.
Well, that would
price to earnings ratio.
That would be an amazing
piece
of real estate.
Really, really nice to have that. And that's why, when we're talking about price to earnings ratio in the market being, you know, in some places at 5 at the down of this last little downturn, of really good companies at 5, that didn't make sense to us. And they're still way below the normal average. And that's because people are afraid. As soon as people start getting greedy, just a little bit greedy, things are going to take off. This is the normal cycle.
Mm-hmm. Well, back in the 1990s, there was something called a cap ratio on real estate. You mentioned real estate.
Right.
Capitalization ratio means net of expense. By the way, when Jake talked about your income from your from your rental property. That's net income. That's right. net of taxes right. and expenses and depreciation and fixing stuff and all that other kind of stuff.
What I would actually call income right. rather than just right. stuff.
In other words, if you're not paying taxes on a piece of real estate, you're losing money.
Right.
And believe me, I've met a lot of people who thought they were making money, but they weren't paying any taxes.
Yeah, I don't have to pay any taxes because on my rental income. Well, then you're not actually making any money.
Right. Vina Van Caspel, who has a lot of warts, who had a lot of warts and pimples, she's long dead now, whose book I read, it was my introduction to financial planning aeons ago, said the nice thing about income taxes is it means you got income. If you're not paying any income taxes, you may think you're in a tax shelter. In fact, it means you don't have income. It's a fake, and you'll pay for it later on. And she was so right. But the point is that the cap rate, national real estate, national something, I don't remember the association, but it's basically the Association of Commercial Real Estate Investors in the United States, people that own the apartment buildings and the business parks and the things like that, who charge rents. And their cap rate across the country, this was struck me as really fascinating, is the ideal cap rate is about 5.5%. In other words, they expect out of a long-term investment in commercial real estate to net about a 5.5% cash flow off of that real estate after they take into account expenses and depreciation and all that other stuff. Now, you look at what I just told you a moment ago, so 1994 to the present, the real return, taking out inflation, the real return of the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index, 1994, 2016, is 5.68%. And whoa, it appears that is the rate of return that is reasonable at this point. And we need to readjust our image of what is a reasonable rate of return. I see people who are taking like 9% out of investments a year,
right,
thinking that somehow the market will rescue them somehow from taking 9% a year out of their investments. All we're seeing right now says that ain't so, and it is unlikely to be so at any time in the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I have an agreement with that. I think this is something that is hard for people to understand. Not only is it not so, but it's never really been so. It's never really ever, if we look back and look at real rates of return, it's never been mm-hmm. possible to consistently pull out 9% from your portfolio every year. You just couldn't do it. And the reason is because that's not the way businesses grow.
Well, but this is...
If you were to... What were you going to
there
say?
There was a period when you could.
Yeah, now, short
no,
period.
No. It was an extended period. You could pull out. Now let me explain this to you. Yeah, I'm going to agree with you. So just you thought you could because you could take out 9% a year, but what you had was 6 to 8% inflation during that period.
Right.
So your 9% a year that you were taking out, or your 8% a year that you were taking out, we used to assume we'd get a 12% per year return in the stock market back in the 1990s. That was just an assumption. You get a 12% per year return in the stock market if you had 3% inflation. 9 plus 3 equals 12. Therefore, if you had all your money in the stock market, you could take out 9% a year and your account would still grow. And lo and behold, from 1994 to 2000, it did.
6 years.
Actually, it did really, really well from about 1982 to 2000. We boomers got an image that that's the way things would work, and that's what I'm talking about. You're right. Yeah. You never really could, but you thought you could for a while. It's kind of like people who had oil wells. During the oil boom, they thought they could take a lot of money out of there and it'd still be worth more money next year.
Right. And it's the same concept. If you look at a stock portfolio or a real estate portfolio or oil portfolio as a business rather than looking at it as some magical means of income, I think that's where people get messed up, is they think, well, these are just numbers and you take this percentage and it just appears in my bank account. You have to run it like a business, which means in the really, really good years, you better be reinvesting for the bad years. You don't take it all as income, or when the bad years come, you're really going to have to dip into your income, or you're going to destroy your own business. Mm-hmm. If you take as much income as you want out of a business in a bad year, then the business goes bankrupt. And
does happen.
And it happens. And it's something that when people do it in business, it's a general consensus. So, man, they should have done that differently. That was really dumb of them. But if you're doing it in a stock market, people act like it's not the same concept, that somehow things are going to magically make more. It's possible to do it. People have done it. It's just more gambling than investing. If you're thinking you're just going to recoup your losses over the years, you need to run it like a business.
By the way, that thing I told you about stock markets being down 2.8% on average in years when the president isn't running,
mm-hmm.
that's from Up and Down Wall Street in Barron's today. In today's edition of Barron's, where it says central banks need more ammo for the bazooka. By the way, there's a new acronym out there, NIRP. NERP.
NERP.
That means negative interest rate policy, which is what's going on in Japan and Europe and everywhere but here.
NERP.
So they've got
NERP.
A name for it now. NERP. Okay, we're going to NERP that.
NERP.
Well, while we're...
We should just start using that in normal conversation.
Yes.
Well, ever since the Europeans NERP'd.
That's right.
We're expecting some growth to happen over there, and people go, he either is just very strange or an economist.
Well,
or both.
It's kind of like QE. We managed to adopt the fact that QE 1, 2, 3, and
right.
This is, by the way, QE 6.
Right. QE 3 and NERP aren't that far apart, if you ask me.
That's right. Anyway, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number's in here. Telephone number in here. We used to have numbers. Now we have number. Area code 254-773-1400. And we mentioned deflation is going on in Europe. And we have said, Jake and I, Jeff, we collectively and individually, that the big threat to the United States economy is deflation. The big threat to the world economy is deflation. And we were saying that back when Glenn Beck and others were screaming we were going to have runaway inflation. Lynn Woody made fun of me for using the deflation word so often. He said I won't go into that anyway. He was scared of inflation too. But the point is that why is deflation so bad? And I think a primer on that again is important. And this is what's going on in Europe right now. If prices are, and think about it, it's going on here. If you expect prices to fall, you will delay spending.
That's seen very easily if you say, I want to get a new TV. Oh, mm-hmm. I'll wait till Christmas.
Right.
It's going to get a better deal there.
And
may even wait till after Christmas to the after Christmas deals.
The after Christmas sale. And,
so there's a Christmas sale and then an after Christmas sale and then the New Year's sale and everything is the price is coming down. That's deflation.
And you would think if banks were paying high interest, people would save more money. And this is one of the conundrums that the Federal Reserve has got to deal with right now. And by the way, the European Central Bank's got to deal with. They lowered interest rates effectively to zero and people saved more money.
Right.
They didn't spend the money. The initial thought was, they won't put the money in the bank because they're not going to get any interest on it. On the other hand, if they're saving like a lot of Americans are today, saving up to get a 20% down payment on a house, you have to save more money at zero interest than you do at a higher interest rate.
Correct.
Pension funds. The lower the interest rate, the lower the federal midterm rate, which is what they're measured by, the more money they have to put in the pension fund to fund future pensions. So as interest rates go down, it actually pulls money out of the economy, and that's one of the conundrums of lowering interest rates. Now, the experiment is the NIRP.
Right, the negative interest rate.
And the issue with deflation, a deflationary spiral can kick in very quickly. One of the issues we're running into is even though hiring has picked up, we've got very low unemployment. As a matter of fact, unemployment is down to what was normally considered full employment at this point. Wages have not appeared to go up. Now, there's an exception to that, and I want to talk about that, but you got something
to
say.
Yeah, I want to go back to foundationally, because people talk about inflation, people talk about deflation, we talk about the symptoms of it, but talking about the causes of it is something that economists don't do very often. You talk about, well, we've got inflation going on, or the deflation, look, the TV costs less now than it did a year ago, blah, blah, blah. Okay, what causes that? Money is made not by the government. They print money, but they print money on request from banks. The banks say, hey, we need to replace this money. And the paper money is just a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the all the money that's out there. If you think about all the money that's in your bank versus the money that you have in your wallet, you think about the money available to you in your credit card versus the cash that you have available. Cash money, paper money, is very, very tiny. So where does the money come from? The money comes from when someone makes a loan and charges interest on that loan, and that loan gets paid back over the full maturity. That interest, some of that is cost to the lender. They've got to pay their employees. They've got to do these other things. But some of that is profit, and it's profit that adds more money that can be loaned later, which can create more money that is loaned and more money after that. The way inflation takes off is when money is being loaned out too fast and it's still getting paid back. Because if you loan a lot of money to a business and they raise all of their employees' earnings, but their employees aren't creating anything new, well, then the employees have more money and they go to the shopping area, and the people at the shopping area realize that they can raise their prices because these people have more money. All you have to do is look at localized areas like San Francisco, where the big tech companies are pulling in high-quality people from all over the country to be paid huge amounts of money. So this massive concentration of wealth, and you go to the grocery store and you pay six times the same amount you would pay someone else, somewhere else for a tomato. That's inflation on a local scale. Inflation happens the same way. All this money is being loaned out, more money. It's being used to pay people wages that they didn't actually necessarily earn. The way you fight inflation is you make it more expensive to get those loans. You raise the interest rates. People go, I don't want to do that. I'm going to have to talk to my employees. I'm not giving them a raise this year based on no additional labor. They're going to have to figure it out because it's going to cost me too much money to give them that raise. And that goes on down. The employee then can't go to the grocery store and say, this year I still have to pay the six-time rate for the tomato instead of the seven-time. That trickles all the way through the system. That's how inflation is fought. Now, deflation is much more dangerous. Deflation happens when loans are harder to get. So employers say, I'm going to have to either lower the pay or I'm going to have to make you work harder to get the same pay that you're already getting. And they can't go to the bank to say, I've really got to give my employees a raise. Nobody else is giving raises at that time, so the competition gets stifled. And the long-term loans, if you got a loan this year, a mortgage this year, and we have deflation over the next 30 years, that means your pay goes down over the next 30 years, but you still have to pay the loan. The loan at that old rate, that payment hasn't gone down. It's gone, in effect, it's gone up by staying the same. And deflation is much more punishing to low-income people. If you have money, it's worth more, but this is the whole thing that happened during the Great Depression.
If you have a loan, it costs more.
Right. If you have a long-term loan, it costs a lot more than it would have if you had inflation. Inflation is bad, but it's not as bad in that if you have runaway inflation, then you may have a 30-year loan, but your payment every year gets less and less because mm-hmm. it's a fixed payment.
It's kind of like, if we had, as we used to have, double-digit inflation, and you have a $100,000 mortgage, effectively 10% inflation knocks 10% off your mortgage every year, which means you feel like you have more money in your pocket, so you have a tendency to go out and spend more money.
Right. It's really dangerous for people that have fixed income, because if you have 10% inflation, 10% of your income just went away because you're getting the same dollar figure.
And there's not a lot of folks left with fixed income.
Right. And that's, they're still out there, but they're not as many.
So another way of looking at it, and a way I like to describe it, is not as specifically accurate as what Jake just did. I use it as blood in the body. Money in our economy is the equivalent of blood in our body. Everything
right.
that goes on requires blood to transfer things from one thing to another. In other words, you breathe, the oxygen comes in, goes to your lung. How does the oxygen get transferred over to the cells so they can use it. Well, it takes blood to do that. In other words, the oxygen converts into oxygenated blood, which then goes to the cell, dumps the oxygen, and moves on. Money is that way. Money moves wealth from one place to another as it is needed. Now, if there's a shortage of money in an economy, the economy winds up with low blood pressure.
Right.
And that's
the cells start failing.
Hypotension. And hypotension, I don't know if you've ever had it, I have, we go into shock. And what happens is you feel dizzy and you feel weak. And I've actually experienced low blood pressure following surgery and things like that, where I couldn't go home the next day because, as the anesthesiologist told me, you actually need to drink more
because it gets your blood up.
Yeah, no, I need to drink more because my liver basically, I wasn't used to having intoxicants in my system, and as a result, my blood pressure stayed down. It took me longer to get the stuff out of my system that had caused me to go to sleep, and as a result, every time I tried to stand up, I'd fall down. I'd get dizzy, and for several days thereafter, I was quite weak. Now, that's called hypotension.
Hypotension and deflation are very similar.
And throughout our economy, in recent history, we've had a problem with hypertension, and we have a lot of advertisement about hypertension, high blood pressure, and we need to take something for the high blood pressure. We're going through low blood pressure, and this is one of the issues in low blood pressure and shock, is it can be caused by a loss of blood. We had a phenomenal loss of money from the system
during
the mortgage crisis, the mortgage securities crisis of 2008 and 2009. We have technically, the Federal Reserve in the United States acted relatively early by infusing more money back into the system. And so the United States is technically, at least, back up on a par with its money supply.
A transfusion from the Federal Reserve. They have a blood bank.
The Federal Reserve is the spleen, and that's what they're supposed to do. And even though Glenn Beck didn't think they were supposed to do it, in Europe they were far more hesitant to do that, far more conservative. And the idea of Europe being more conservative than the United States, they are.
Very much so when it comes financially.
And as a result, they're coming in very late to the game now, but the United States economy is still lagging to some degree for a couple of reasons. One is psychological. We think we're sick because we're being told every day by the presidential candidates that we're sick.
Both sides of the equation.
And the second reason is that we're not alone in the world. To some degree, the health of our nation is affected by our trading partners. If our trading partners are not buying as much as they used to because they're not economically healthy, it does slow our economy down a little bit. Now, we potentially could get a boost. The Chinese goods become less expensive. We could get a potential boost from the fact that we buy stuff at a cheaper price. The problem with that is it would again cause prices to start to fall. Now, here's the key to that. The heart has to beat at a certain speed to get the blood pressure up. You can put all the blood into a body you want to, but if the heart never speeds up, the blood pressure will never rise. The heart in the United States is running a little slow right now. Now, what I mean by that, if you delay buying something because you think the price will be lower later, you're slowing down the speed with which money moves through the economy. Money moves through the economy based on people spending money. If you're not spending as much money as you used to because you're a little scared, you're concerned about things, you're not investing, you're not spending, you're slowing the system down. And in Europe, the system had ground to a halt where banks weren't loaning money so people could spend it.
I'm going to give an example of this that people listening are going to be able to recognize in their own life. What happens when we have an attitude about prices? Like, we think prices are going up, so we want to buy them as soon as possible because prices are going to be more expensive later. And if you think about when gas prices are going up, people top off more. There's studies out about that. When prices first start falling, people top off even more, because they still think, I better get a hold of this before prices go up. as prices continue to fall, they get more and more relaxed about how often they fill up because prices are going to be down later. If I wait just a little bit, I'll spend less on at the pump. And we've all been through that in the last year and a half. Right now, gas prices are kind of stabilizing, but you remember the first time that you saw gas below $2 a gallon?
I took a picture of the sign.
People went, oh my goodness, I'm going to go fill up immediately as soon as I can because we think, oh, it's going to come right back up as soon as possible. Now we see $1.50 to $1.80. Nobody gets excited about it. You take your time in getting the gas because we have an idea that gas is going to stay relatively stable. Now that's the idea that the American people have. That idea is rarely right, but it does influence prices. It does make prices move faster when they start moving. If prices start up and people start thinking, oh no, prices are going to go up really fast, then you get lines at the pump, which is what we've seen in the past when prices go up really fast. Do you really think that if the price is going up 20% today, then you better, maybe it's all going to be gone tomorrow? Well, that kind of invades the way we think. And when deflation takes hold, people have less reason to work hard because they know their pay is going to go down. And that's psychological. Even if somebody tells you, well, with deflation, that's going to buy the same amount that you had last year, it's still depressing to look at your paycheck being less than it was before. That's what's happening in Europe. And it's really hard to come out of that because all the psychology of it is negative. Coming out of inflation, it's almost like coming off of an upper. You've got the hypertension going, or you've got somebody's giving you a lot of stimulants and you're just going so fast, but you're getting more blood into the system than you can use. And so it's bad for you. Your blood pressure goes up. You can burn out, and economies burn out by having the inflation take off and go double, triple digits. And we had that in the 1970s. Ronald Reagan came in and was taking the helm during a double-digit inflation time period. And we thought, well, maybe this is the new normal. And thankfully, rational minds got in control at the Federal Reserve, and inflation dropped off very quickly. It was expensive. It was painful. It hurt a lot of people. It caused recessions. Some of the first recessions during Ronald Reagan's term were caused because they were yanking blood out of the system.
Mm. Well, it's what the Federal Reserve does. Is when we have inflation, we have too much money in the system, and it's moving too fast. By literally going into the reverse, selling bonds on the open market.
Right.
By raising interest rates, it slows the heart down, effectively. And by selling bonds on the open market, the Federal Reserve can come back in and actually pull money out of the system. Now, the funny thing is, there's an interesting thing going on right now, and that is the Federal Reserve is in the position of neutral right now. Even if it raises two more times this year to from its current 0.25 to 0.5 and then up to 0.75, it will still be in neutral mode. At some point, it owns a lot of bonds right now. The Federal Reserve, that's why they say its balance sheet is up. Actually, it owns a tremendous number of bonds that are worth more than they paid for them, which is a fascinating thing, which means that if they were to start selling those bonds onto the open market, a really interesting thing would happen. They would effectively be pulling money back out of the system again, and they are prepped to do that. So the threat of runaway inflation is pretty nearly zero at this point because the Federal Reserve at some point is going to sell those bonds back out onto the open market. And when they sell the bonds onto the open market, it has the opposite effect of quantitative easing. We want to pray for Europe and we want to pray for Japan that their quantitative easing works. The United States is the biggest contributor to world GDP. We, depending on who you read or who you listen to, actually produce about 20% of the world's gross domestic product with about 4% of the people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, China, we really don't know what's going on. China officially announced
We just had some
that they have a GDP growth target of 6.5 to 7%, which was higher.
Yeah, they just came out with some other news about their industrial output coming down. It's still expanding, but it's not expanding anywhere near as fast. And some of their industrial output is right at the edge of barely putting anything.
Well, actually, there's a negative here too. And imports, China's imports fell in February by 13.8%.
Mm-hmm.
Compared with a year earlier. And their exports dropped by 17.8%. I'm sorry, it's 17.8% in exports and 16.7% in imports. They dropped. If the Chinese are slowing down, then the world economy is likely to suffer from hypotension and has the potential to go into shock. And this is where the central banks need to inject a little adrenaline into the system. They need to transfuse some blood into the system. And hopefully, and I think they are, they're doing it in somewhat of a coordinated fashion. However, in the United States, we're getting well much faster than the rest of the world. We are, in many aspects, well already.
We were given a transfusion a lot earlier.
And as a result, we're going to be raising interest rates. Now, this is going to be an interesting, to say the least, position. If in Europe, let's say you're a multibillionaire, and in Europe you're scared about investing your money, so you're getting not only a zero return, you're getting a negative return. You're having to pay
just to deposit
to have your money deposited in the bank. But if you move it to the United States and you buy dollars, you could get maybe 0.75% or 1% on your money.
I've got
that has a threat to make the dollar go even higher.
Right. We did this in the United States back in 2010. In 2010, the United States charged negative interest or gave negative interest charged money for deposits at the very, very large scale size. For instance, Bank of New York Mellon was charging people with $100 million on deposit. They were charging them money to have it on deposit. And so we did it in the United States, but it wasn't on a governmental level. Bank of New York was saying at that point, we're not going to make money with this money. If they show up, this is a short-term deposit. If they show up and they say, I want my $100 million, we got to give it to them right then, which means that we can only put it in short. And in short, you're paying zero. We're getting paid 0% from the government to leave it in fully liquid assets. We've got to charge money to have this money on deposit.
By the way, one of the things that came out of the archive document release this week on financial documents that were part of the investigation of the crash, every major bank in the United States had TARP not been enacted.
Mm-hmm.
And very critically, had Bank of America not bought Merrill Lynch, because Merrill Lynch was one day away from bankruptcy. If those two things had not happened, every major bank in the United States, according to the documents, would have failed but one.
Yeah, well, that's Bank of New York Mellon.
Yes.
They've just been very, very conservative. That's not saying that they're the best place in the world, but they've been very conservative in how they use assets.
I thought that was a pretty significant announcement, actually.
Now, at this point, stress tests are showing that there are no major banks that would fail with equivalent shocks to the system, which is an amazing. That's not true in Europe. It's not true at all in Europe. It's not true in Asia. It's not true in Japan. In Japan, all of the banks are technically failed already. Not all of them. Most of them.
And something the president said yesterday, I think, which is important, he said that there's this sense that nothing has changed since the crisis. We passed all these bills and nothing changed. In fact, a lot has changed. He said that, and that's absolutely correct. We now have a law that says if you're big enough, if an entity is big enough financially that it causes a systemic risk to the rest of the system, it comes under the regulation of the Federal Reserve, and that includes insurance companies in some cases. And as a result, they're required to capitalize up to a worst-case scenario, which they weren't before. So
that's also slowed down growth, and that's money that they've had to retain rather than put out. But it leaves us in a much healthier, safer place going forward now that they have the capital levels, now that we have enough money to move forward, we expect expansion, give or take the presidential election.
Speaking of enough money to move forward, we have to do commercials because KTEM needs to stay on the air, and they sell commercial time, and Town Square Media needs to stay in business so KTEM can stay on the air and all that kind of stuff. So we're going to break for commercials. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. We'll be back on the other side just barely. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And all I got to say is the economy is doing well. I can tell by the number of commercials.
Yes, we had a lot of commercials.
And as we were coming back yesterday from South Padre, which was a grand place to be if you like thunderstorms and rain and cold and wind, we noticed something. There were innumerable, that's my word for the day, innumerable trucks on the highway.
Which means that there's not a number for them.
I couldn't count them.
You didn't have a number.
They were countless trucks on the highway.
You counted them not at all, so you less counting.
There were a bunch.
Were you counting less or just not counting at all?
We gave up trying to count because there were just too many of them. It would be too distracting. And the other thing is something different has happened. Apparently, it's already been tested in the United States, and I didn't know it. I saw it in the Financial Times. The United Kingdom is testing truck trains, automated truck trains, where the drivers are in what we used to call a convoy.
Right. Only there's
a computer driving the front truck, only on the interstates and on regular highways, and then there's a series of trucks behind them at an interval that are tracking the front truck. And if the front truck puts its brakes, if the computer puts the brakes on in the front trucks, all the other brakes are applied simultaneously so they can really drive relatively close together and at relatively high speeds. And this is the beginning of the driverless automobile. By the way,
well, it's one of the beginnings. They're also testing driverless cars in London. They've been going on in Austin. I drive by a driverless car in Austin pretty regularly.
That we're kind of used to that. But the issue of seeing a stream of identical trucks going down the highway with the drivers with their hands off the wheels is already happening.
Right.
The other thing is General Motors just spent $1 billion buying technology, buying a company with a technology for driverless cars. This is getting serious, folks.
At some point, it's not going to be driverless cars. It's just going to be cars. And you're going to say that car has a driver.
Well, it's like horseless carriages.
Right.
Which became car.
Right.
Became car.
Horseless car and then car.
So
it's still going to be car.
We tend to get focused at this moment in time on the immediate issues that are in front of us, but an absolutely earth-shakingly huge thing, and some of the people in the auto industry who are deeply traditional auto industrial people have said this is the biggest change since the introduction of the internal combustion engine, and it is going to be so huge, and if you just live a few more years, you're going to see it happen.
Two big things just got announced today, or not today, this week, this last week. One is the Solar City folks, an Elon Musk firm, have just announced that the production of a new type of solar panel is beginning. They've got the manufacturing facility set up that is less expensive and more energy efficient than the last one. And the difference is between 16% efficiency and 22% efficiency, which people go, what the heck are we talking about here? That's a huge jump in moving forward with solar being a viable source of energy when oil prices are low. So if he can make it just a little bit further before the subsidies go away, then he may have a profitable item if he makes the next big leap. And when he's combining it with the new battery technology that's coming out of there too, it could be a very viable thing in the future. It has not been. And part of the problem has been the subsidies have meant that they didn't need to get more efficient. I think Elon Musk sees the subsidies stopping at some point and goes, we need to get to a point where we're profitable. The other big one, the other big thing just happened in South Korea in an experimentation. They were able to get 100% efficiency in splitting water, getting all of the molecules split correctly. And that may seem like a tiny thing, but it's huge, and we're out of time. It's really, really big for the future. Okay, so if you would like to contact us off the air.
Local telephone number. Telephone, you'll get a voicemail on the weekend. Live people during the week, 947-1111.
Toll free is 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us directly, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. Listen to podcasts, see our ugly mugs. Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth.
Truth. It's not just a word on your Fox News station. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.